Hello, I'm Howard David Ingham. Back in April, John Deere suggested to me that we start doing a podcast together, and I jumped at the chance. I don't know anyone as knowledgeable and passionate as John on the subject of film and television, and we've got a lot in common in terms of taste, but we also approach the things we watch in very different ways, as you can see if you read John's blog, viewsfromahill.com, and mine, room207press.com. For us, though, it's been an opportunity to talk, since I live in West Wales and John in London, at opposite ends of the M4. We agreed for our first outing to watch David Keating's 2009 film Wake Wood, which came in right at the beginning of the renaissance of folk horror that we've had in recent years and which neither of us had seen. It took me a while to get the thing edited, partly because I discovered too late that my mic was terrible. It was muffled sounding, but here it is. I hope the sound quality doesn't detract from your enjoyment. Welcome then to episode one of the M4 Death Trip, Wake Wood. I stumbled across Wakewood because I've been doing this blog about folk horror movies for 6 months, a series of posts on my blog about folk horror generally, and it's become a kind of consuming obsession for me. And as I was looking at folk horror, Wakewood kept getting mentioned in the same breath as things like A Field in England and The Witch and Kill List, and as part of, you know, the folk horror revival, not to steal the name of the people who published books in that Facebook group that we're both part of, but, you know, I was reading things about folk horror movies and keeping an eye out for stuff to watch, and people were giving this as an example of a piece of new folk horror, and that, you know, that piqued my interest, and so I thought, yes, I'll watch it. How about you?
Again, it's from things like searches of, you may be interested in this, I think it came up, but interestingly, it came up much later than when I first heard of it. I didn't probably first hear about Wake Wood until about a year or so ago. But it came out, I mean, it was made in about 2009, released in 2011, as one might expect, very, very limited. So you often find with such films that their reputation takes time as word of mouth becomes one of the more effective means of its marketing. But I heard it probably in connection with, you like A Field in England, have you seen?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And I hadn't. And then it also been a bit of the back burner of something I'd sort of want to watch, and then when we discussed doing this and I suggested that it would be good to start off with something neither of us had seen. What pre-knowledge did you come to the film with? I came with, once I knew we were going to do it, and thus thought, right, I don't really want to then go, oh, I know this is a film directed by, it's released in, it played at a Fright Fest or wherever. I decided to go in as blind as I could. Good, and then read up later. But after I'd formed an opinion of the film itself, but did you have much pre-knowledge of the film?
I looked up. I couldn't find many reviews of it, but I found a synopsis that said, you know, Aidan, what's his name, the guy who played Tommy Carchetti on The Wire.
Aidan Gillen.
Yeah, Aidan Gillen. Of course it was, and Eva Birtwistle, who, you know, you've seen odd things. They play a couple, their child died, they move into a spooky rural community that has a secret in that they can bring people back from the dead, and they try and get their kid back from the dead, and it goes wrong. And that's the synopsis I found. And I thought, yeah, I'm not sure I want to watch that. Because being a parent, I find that things where horrible things happen to kids, very difficult to watch. But I don't know why I relented. I think I saw it for £2 on Amazon one day, and I thought, oh, what the hell, I'll get it. I'll eventually bring myself to watch it.
Oh, you did better than me then. I got it for £3.50. So it would probably is probably best if we move on to the film itself. The first thing that struck me when we were watching it was how quickly the child dies. I thought there was going to be, I mean, the child, it's totally flashback as they drive, the couple. I expected some level of engagement with the kids, but there's no more than about one scene of the child's birthday and her being given a hamster before there's a rather awkward shooting with the kid, a German shepherd, and some ham. That's ham. As in the meat, not a judgment on any performance.
Although Timothy Spall.
But yet Timothy Spall has not appeared at this point. So
yeah, one point.
But I was surprised how quickly we cut to the chase, almost as an afterthought in flashback during the breaking up editing of a car journey. The child is very, very gruesomely mauled to death by a German shepherd, which I found a little crass. But more than that, that's more personal choice in how it was portrayed. But I was surprised how quickly it was done in the narrative. Yeah. I didn't get a sense of either the couple's relationship with each other, with the child. Were they happy when they had the child? Or how close they were to their child. I mean, I'm making the assumption that they all love their children and stuff as well. But was there any detail? Did the mum prefer? Like, was the mum closer to the father? Was the mum closer to the daughter, or the father closer to the daughter? Anything that you might see played out, given what happens later in the film when the dead child is resurrected. But there's nothing to go on. There really isn't.
You know, there's the basic happy family signifiers, which are there, and they're not really shown. It's just basic, very simple signifiers that go, you know, body language and stuff like that. Here's a hamster for your birthday. Here she is cuddling the hamster. Oh, we're having a lovely time, aren't we? Great. Are we happy? Ah, she's dead.
But and because of that, that lack of relationship or lack of investigation into their relationship, you probably learn fairly early on that this isn't going to be something where the relationship with the child will become apparent or be important after the child has been resurrected, other than for the spectacle itself of here's our zombie daughter. And I think that started me off on I'm not sure I'm going to like this as much as I can. It might have been far more interesting to explore the nature of the relationships with the parents and how it deals, particularly when you find out that it's established that they have 3 days with the child and that is it. The child will then have to go back. And all that means. But it doesn't. It's more because obviously it's not about the child. It's about the parents' obsession with seeing the child and having yet to go. The child's been dead, as it turns out, just over a year. They're not through the grief process as they, you know, in the letting go sense. So they have to, you know, they still want to be with the child, and giving them a chance to be with the child, but only for 3 days, and all the problems that will bring when those 3 days are up. But I felt the film missed an opportunity by just having almost that as the spectacle, rather than exploring the relationship that they had within those 3 days with their child.
Yeah, and I mean, it was as crass as hell. Mm. You know, suddenly she's covered in blood. She's been mauled by a German shepherd. It was a German shepherd, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
Yeah, no, that's right. Because I remember I was upset because I just see the child being mauled, and you were upset because it was a German shepherd. And
I love German
shepherds. Yeah.
Not given a German shepherd needs to be right. No German shepherd would maul a child like that. I don't know that that's true. I've not demonstrated saying that. My mother's had German shepherds for many years. I love
it. I mean, and all that was before the credits.
Yeah, I mean, and having them set up, they now live in this community. It isn't really established why they've moved to that community, other than the vet's getting a bit older. The vet, the old vet played by Timothy Spall, in a bizarre role for him to be doing. Whether anyone was calling in any favours or whether they just had him for 2 days, but it seems an ill fit, and he doesn't totally convince as the village elder, if you like.
Yeah, and I mean, he is filling that role in pagan village conspiracy movies. There is like the elder statesperson who is basically the mouthpiece generally. Although, to be fair to the film, several of the people in the community did have voices and characters of a sort.
Although you wonder how badly they were edited out, but it's a film, isn't it? You only be so many ways. But initially, I was concerned with, I'm not sure why he's moved here. I mean, you can leave the short term in moving to get away, new start, new life, new challenge, throw myself into work as a vet in the community. But did he answer an ad? Was there communication with Timothy Spall's character beforehand? How was he put on the radar? Did he know when he was offered the job that he'd had a young daughter die? All of that sort of left up in the air, and again feels a little unsatisfying. But as you said last night, when he was talking about him being a vet is narratively useful. It's can make an easy play of modern, a man of learning, having a justifiable reason to be in a rural community as opposed to just a visitor.
Yeah, and of course Nigel Neal used it twice in folk horror scripts. Yeah, and I mean, and obviously the vet also gives you a chance to show some more gratuitous gore because he does a cow cesarean, and they filmed an actual cow cesarean, didn't they?
They did, yes. It didn't look like special effects to me, particularly on the budget. You would assume the film has.
They must have actually gone to a farm and watched the film The Cow Cesarean. How they managed to like get that happen? I mean, do cow cesareans happen a lot? I can't believe I've said the words cow cesarean so many times at the last minute.
You know, I've ever even contemplated cow cesareans in my life before yesterday when I watched
the film. Yeah, and I think it's interesting. It's interesting, actually, how we responded to it, because I was like, oh, well, that's gratuitous, isn't it? And you went, yeah, but just you watched.
Yeah, but there was obviously some reason why Chekhov C-section. We need to be shown that he can perform a cesarean.
On a cow.
Yeah, on a cow. He's a vet. And a vet in a rural community, you're going to do a lot of farm work. You're going to do a lot of cows. But the reason for showing him doing a C-section on a cow, other than just shoving his hand up a sheep's bottom, if he was just trying to show him in with the locals, establishing him, was to show he could perform a C-section if he needed to. And I thought that was an obvious, there's going to be a callback on that.
But actually, although you were right, that actually creates massive problems with the film later on.
It does with, because we're skipping to the end of the film, the once again, dead daughter takes the mother with her. The mother just discovers she's pregnant. And when Aidan Gillen's character, who has name,
Patrick.
Patrick, thank you. Decides very, in a very good bed that he's going to bring her back. She's pregnant. The pregnancy has progressed enough that he is now going to apparently perform a C-section to try and take his presumably undead child out. But seeing as the mother died only days into the pregnancy, how was the fetus gestated post-mortem?
Yeah, how can you gestate beyond the grave?
Because this is a film that is using ideas and spectacle rather than any depth to address those things. A resurrected daughter. Oh my God, she's going around killing people because Patrick and Louise have lied about how long she's been dead, and there are these self-important rules. But that's where the interest of the film lies, not necessarily with the relationship with the family. And in a similar vein, oh my God, he's going to cut his presumably undead child out of his zombie wife. And we know he can do that because he's handy with a knife and getting a fetus out of a woman. This is a film that says, let's throw this in. Wouldn't it be cool? And just don't think about it much or indeed at all. And I think you said when we were watching it, it's a film that leaves next to nothing to the imagination and shows far more than it probably should.
Yeah. I'll go back to like points of interest in the film because I had some thoughts about that, but the fact that the film does really like to show you everything explicitly, and I think particularly of a scene where a woman has been stabbed and you see the blood coming out of her mouth, and then it flashes to like the zombie daughter, and then you see more blood coming out of the woman's mouth, and it's almost as if they're like going, okay, some blood, and here's some more blood, and let's go and have another look at that blood. No, just once more.
Well, it ends with the zombie daughter ripping the woman's heart out. But when they cut back about the third time, they cut back to the reaction shot of the woman dying horribly, blood coming out of her mouth. I was reminded of the Big Train's Shaka Khan and the Bee Gees sketch. If you've seen that, when Shaka Khan shoots one of the Gibbs played by, I think one of the end they do it with is Kevin Eldon. And she's only got a six shooter. But regardless of that, she shoots Kevin Eldon maybe 30, 40 times. And it just keeps going with Kevin Eldon like reacting as he's like being pumped full of bullets. And they cut back to it like five or six times. And then as he starts to fall in slow motion, she starts again. And then he's still being pumped full of bullets. And it brought that to mind with the third or fourth reaction shot of the woman being horribly mutilated to death by the zombie daughter, and undercut the horror of the piece with some ill-deserved and presumably unintended humour. But the gratuitous violence also has another detrimental effect on the film, in that there's next to no tension. And this is meant to be into folk horror. The creeping dread of the unknown should be paramount to what you're experiencing. Yet everything goes by one so quickly. Things are developed fairly rapidly before they've really time to just stay to your mind. You're on to the next thing, and there's no real sympathy with the characters as they're portrayed. And because there's no level of tension, there's no great unknown, there's no sort of slow build up. You're not left with the creeping dread that I think is fundamental to the best folk horror.
But also the characters who you're supposed to be the audience identification figures are supremely unsympathetic.
Yes, and indeed the most interesting aspect of the film, and something that if you said, this is the selling point of this film, I'd have gone, oh, that's genuinely interesting, in that it's... While it's certainly the pagan village conspiracy holds up as its central plot, it's turned on its head by the fact that ultimately all the villagers try to do is help the couple when they've requested it, and it's the couple's duplicity, it's the couple's selfishness. That gets large numbers of the villagers and themselves killed. Not anything the villagers do. The villagers are under threat from the zombie daughter, who's unleashed by the couple themselves, albeit unwittingly. But done so because they lied.
Because of middle class entitlement, basically.
Yeah, that's entirely it. And although they seem an intimidating and insular lot in Wakewood, they had accepted the new family into the community. They were part of the community. She was a pharmacist. He's a vet, and they weren't threatened at no point. Their lives weren't threatened. They weren't in any way under threat from living there. They caused it themselves.
And in fact, actually, when they stumble across the secret of the pagan village conspiracy, Tim Spall rocks up in their house, and that could be creepy, but what he says is, do you want in?
Yeah.
And in a horribly clumsy scene.
Yes, and there's also, there's that slightly, there's that line I was slightly uncomfortable with, when it's like, basically, why did you let yourself into my house? And it's, well, we're the countryside, we're in each other's houses all the time. You're not. If people in my mum's village just let themselves into each other's houses, there would be a lot of upset people. I thought that was a rather crass line. Oh, look, country people, they do this. They seem to speak of urban privilege, but they're absolutely right in that it's the middle class privilege of we want this, and we'll tell you whatever you want to hear. So they lie because the daughter has, but for it to work properly, the daughter has to have been dead less than a year. So they lie and undercut it by a month when she's been dead for just over a year.
It's interesting when he says how long has she been in the ground, and he says 11 months, 2 weeks, and 2 days. And it's like, that's how long she's been in the ground.
Yes.
But how long has she been dead? And of course, it's another couple of weeks beyond that, over a year. And the interesting thing is that I don't think the film is making a critique of the middle class privilege that's going on there. The film, I think, goes with the entitlement because of the things where it like makes all these rather patronising statements about working class rural people. I think the filmmakers are rooting for Patrick and Louise, but you know, I couldn't, you know, watching this film, they're riding roughshod over local traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said earlier on, Louise gets dragged down to hell with the daughter, and then the villagers go back to Mr. Patrick and say, do you want to bring your wife back?
Possibly, but I was thinking about this today, and maybe I could need to watch it again. But there's a quick montage, but the montage seems to be Patrick on his own. And I'm wondering, does he do this without the knowledge of the villagers?
Well no, because they show the scene with everybody there.
Oh, do they? Okay, right, fine.
Yeah, at the end, there's the ritual, you know, and of course the film closes with her being 8 or 9 months pregnant, and him having his cow cesarean materials ready, and then he looks right at the camera.
Yeah, as in says, I'm going to cut my baby out of my dead wife. Cue title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anybody listening to this will of course come to the conclusion that we didn't like it that much on the whole.
No, and it had... But it had the ingredients there. It had the setting. It had an interesting way of the supernatural, the resurrection element to it as well, with just enough arcane rules. It's got to be 3 days because that's how long the energy of the fresh cadaver will sustain, etc. Yeah. And so there was all of it that creates sort of an interesting setup. You can't leave the confines of the village, otherwise your mortal state will return. And you had the interesting inversion of the pagan village conspiracy, where you had the civilized ones unwittingly screwing everything up when the villagers are all just trying to help you.
And are basically nice people.
Nice people, yeah. They are weird pagans, but that doesn't make them bad people. They're not trying to burn or kill anyone. They do this very disturbing practice, but it doesn't hurt anyone, providing everyone stays within the rules that the outside middle class couple trample over. And interestingly, you conclude, but before I did, that you think that's unwitting on the part of the filmmakers.
Yeah, I don't think the filmmakers thought it through, and that's the problem. I think because the film strikes me actually, and I mean, obviously we haven't mentioned this, but it's a Hammer film. It's a resurrected Hammer. Of course, Hammer had one big hit with the Daniel Radcliffe version of The Woman in Black,
which was made after this, wasn't it?
Yeah. So this predates New Hammer actually coming into their own, as it were. I mean, I didn't like the Daniel Radcliffe Woman in Black, but, you know.
No, it wasn't.
I just thought it was a really cynical movie. It had a laundry list of horror film things that it had to tick off. And even though it's a movie that, as we've said, turns the pagan village conspiracy on its head, it's still was incredibly predictable. You know, we were predicting plot elements right, left and centre, weren't we? You know, a hand coming out of the ground on fire. She's dead.
To be fair to them, there's lots of films where you can play probability games of who you think's going to who's not going to make the end credits in a horror film.
But we weren't wrong at any point.
No.
there wasn't a single prediction that we made that didn't come off.
And in terms of its production, I mentioned to you that I thought it looked quite European.
Yeah.
You said it's often it's part documentary filmed. It looks like it's, so there's like, you know, there's various sort of shoulder height shots. I'm guessing deliberately the filmmaker David Keating. He's made Cherry Tree. One film since which I haven't seen, but I'm going to assume it's deliberate when he has sort of like, it's almost like they're, in inverted commas, badly laid out in shot, but it's realism, as you know. So you'll have a shot over the shoulder of a person who's partly obscuring the person that they're standing in front of, and there's a person to the next, and that's a tight three shot. You wouldn't frame a shot like that unless either you didn't know what you were doing, or you wanted it to look more reportage, and I'm guessing that that's what he was doing. But it's a lot more, you find it a lot more common in my experience anyway, in Europe than I've seen in English language films, shall we say.
And of course, the guy in charge of the cinematography.
Yes, you haven't seen Frostbite.
Yeah, I haven't seen Frostbite, but yeah, he did Frostbite, and I looked at his IMDb page and it's all things made in Russia and Scandinavia.
Yes. It's clear that he probably saw something like Frostbite or other films that that the cinematographer had done and thought, that's how I want it. That's the feel I want for my film. And I think we saw when the credits came up, it was partly filmed in Sweden.
Yes, and because, of course, that's where you want Ireland to look like Ireland. Sweden.
That could just be because of the cinematographer, Chris Maris, that was it. Because that was maybe due to Chris Maris's availability, and he said, I can do it on these dates, I have to be in Sweden, I'll shoot it, but I'll have to be in driving distance from my house or from the studio. Something about that. I can't, for all I know, that was the reason they filmed partly in Sweden.
It was made on a super low budget, obviously, so, but I think you're right. Although it could have been incompetent, I don't think it was incompetent. I think they were deliberately framing shots in that way.
No, I think so. I think that in terms of directorial tropes, he's the director knows what he wants. I mean, he's like, the editing was confident, where it fell down was, one, it showed far too much, and there was no tension. There was the scene towards the end with the birds, the dead birds in front of the,
all in a row, all hundreds of them on the path. And I thought, you know, in a better film, that would have been amazing.
Yeah, and I was rather nonplussed. There's also major problems. Again, this may be to do with reshoots and budget, but nevertheless, I can only go with the evidence I see on screen. There was major problems with the lighting. There was day for night shots, cutting with actual night shoot. The contrast was stark. The contrast was 70s BBC cutting between 60mm film and videotape stark, in that this is clearly shot either at a different time or with using very different equipment, and that took me out of the drama a bit. And you were a bit critical of the sound, weren't you?
Yeah, no, the sound design was like really, really extreme, wasn't it? It's a bit where she runs out of the house and she's a bit.
Oh, that's right. They hug and it's.
And goes and like runs into his arms, like that. And the film's all full of like massive, over the top horror music all the time. And sometimes you think, if you're gonna do a folk horror or a film that obviously deliberately rips off classic folk horror, you might tone it down a bit.
Yes, it's often, it's not clear that it's not controversial to say it's what you, or original to say it's what you don't see that makes it more frightening. But it's in folk horror, I'll return again to the theme of something that makes something scary, is the creeping dread. And that can be an incredibly slow burner. The early stages of it's not particularly sinister in the sense that, you know, there's something wrong, but the building to the horror is very slow and steady all the way through it. But like many good films, you're not entirely sure of what the genre of something you're watching, even to the closing credits in terms of The Wicker Man. But it's going somewhere very different to to folk horror art. You're not sure where this is or how this is built up. There's nothing to quickly throw you into. My God, son, there's death, there's blood, there's horror. And that's no number saying that's particularly a folk horror because Blood on Satan's Claw and Witchfinder General have no qualms about hugely exploitative and problematic violence and gore. So it's not to say it's not of folk horror generally, but I'd argue that those films are actually rather poor, regardless of making folk horror doesn't make it a genre, is a genre, it doesn't make them good. But the best make the creeping dread, and something say that Field in England does incredibly well.
And the Witch.
And The Witch. I need to rewatch The Witch. I don't sort of like The Witch as much as everybody else liked The Witch. And I thought the ending was very silly. That final scene with the other witches.
A lot of people had a problem with the ending. But anyway, yeah, that's a film that we should do, I think.
I need to rewatch it. I saw it when it came out at the film festival, so that's October 2015. So yeah, I probably deserve it on the rewatch. And I will add it to Kill List and Barbarian Sound Studio. In films that I didn't like, I don't particularly like when I first saw them, but probably need to give another chance.
But yeah, going back to Wake Wood, I think the other thing about folk horror that you often see is a sense of inevitability, a sense it was you they wanted all along, twist, which happens in some form or another in a lot of folk horror things, but the way in which it's inexorable and it creeps up on you, and there's no way out. It was always going to be this way. And sometimes the final reveal at the end of the movie is that this is how it was always going to be. And even though, right from the beginning, in fact, before the big plot development kicks off in Wake Wood, even though it's inexorable and you know how it's going to end, there's no tension. It doesn't creep up on you. There's no big reveal or anything like that. It just sort of happens.
There's on the one hand, you'll have the motivations of the parents who are all too clear. They just want to see their daughter and aren't thinking of anything beyond that. I mean, they try and escape, like, even though they must know that that's impossible the moment they go over the boundaries. But the motivations of the villagers I'd like to have seen explore a bit more. We have the wife of the farmer who is killed rather stupidly when he gets crushed by his own prize bull.
Yeah, by getting into this pen behind the bull.
And being crushed to death, he's a fairly incompetent farmer, presumably farmer, aware to the dangers of handling prize bulls. Anyway, she's clearly the character whom we focus on when she knows that something is wrong. She's the one that will highlight the fact that the villagers will know that the parents shouldn't be doing this. But she's persuaded by Tinsmas otherwise. And you have that scene where the villagers appear in the only probably slightly tense moment, when the villagers appear en masse with their banging wood outside the family's house. But you know that she's dead because she's clearly the most dangerous one of the villagers as far as the resurrected child is concerned. But I'd hope there'd be sort of one or two more that would come, but they weren't. And it's a film that isn't going to spare too much in the way of characterization. I don't really understand. Is it Arthur, Timothy Spall's character?
Yeah.
I don't think either of us doubt Timothy Spall's competence as an actor, but it's pretty fair to say not giving his all in that production. But he isn't given a huge amount to work with, other than the village elder, the leader of the conspiracy, and the person to whom is able to summon this magic. But we know nothing about him other than he was coming up to retirement and appointed a younger vet. Did he appoint him deliberately? Or does he want him to take over from him? Will another villager take over when he's gone? Does he have a loved one? that he's done this with.
Yeah.
You didn't get any of that, and it ultimately left the film being a little empty. It didn't have the tension. It was overly gratuitous in terms of the gore, and you had no sympathy with the lead characters, and ultimately the final reveal makes no sense, and from my perspective was somewhat predictable.
Yeah, and I mean that's really quite an achievement, isn't it? You make a film with a final reveal that is absolute nonsense and yet completely predictable.
That is pretty damning. So half a Burning Wicker Man out of five.
Yes, 1.5 claws.
You've been listening to the M4 Death Trip, Episode 1, Wakewood. You can find John's writing at viewsfromahill.com and my own at room207press.com. The theme music was very kindly given to us by The Hare and the Moon. Thanks for listening.